You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Another part that I guess we touched on earlier, the treatment of the Marines by non-Marines or people who weren't on the line. You referred to them, Howard, by the acronym REMF. You want to tell the listeners what that stands for? You don't have to say the whole thing.
I'm not going to tell you what it
they,
meant.
They got to read the book, right?
If you don't know, you don't need to know.
All right, there you go. I know what it is, and I'm not going to say it. Listeners, you're going to have to get the book to find out what it is. Well, REMF, we're talking about the people in the rear. So you guys are on the line. You guys are fighting and bleeding and seeing things that you never could imagine you would ever see as 20-year-old. And you were 18, Howard, is that right?
Yeah, I just turned 18.
An 18-year-old and a 20-year-old seeing these things get imagine it nowadays where we all know people that age and think about them seeing what you guys had to see at that young age. But there was another part of Iwo Jima that you talked a lot about, Howard, the people in the rear. Now, I just want to read something here. And Ray, you talked about it too, but not in the way that Howard did. You did mention the people in the rear. On page 73, Howard, you say, people in the rear lived in relative comfort, worked regular days, and stood regular watches at night against possible Jap infiltrators. They had hot meals, a medical dispensary, hot showers, and outhouses, all in duplicate, one for enlisted men, and a much better and more private one for officers. Even out here, the officers had special privileges. They ate separately, their head was surrounded by a canvas screen, while users of the enlisted men's head were visible to everybody for miles around. And of course, the head is the bathroom, not their head. Let me get to this also. This is an important paragraph. It was often said by philosophers in the Corps that these and other chicken shit things were heaped on the enlisted men for a reason, to build up their frustration and hatred to the bursting point, so that when they were pushed off a landing craft onto an enemy beach, they would take that hatred out on the Japs. All too often, the stupidity and pettiness of the orders we got from our own officers seemed to support that theory. We were always being prohibited from doing something quite trivial or inconsequential, and those prohibitions on us always seemed to result in additional pleasure or convenience for the officers. Now, anybody who's going to read this book is going to quickly understand how you feel about the officers, Howard, and of course, my experience in the Navy was similar, although I was never in combat. As a Marine, however, it wasn't just the officers that gave you a hard time, but it was basically everyone. Every Marine that wasn't on the line, they treated you pretty much like garbage, right?
Yeah. You're out there, do your job, and then I won't have to be inconvenienced back here where I am. I'll get my Purple Heart, I'll get my Combat Star, and whatnot. That's all. Up where we were, Combat Star didn't mean anything. Purple Heart was something that you got, but it wasn't something that you went out looking for, I'll tell you that. Where back in the rear areas, there was considerable mention of the fact that somebody would use the head there, which would be just a couple of wooden planks stretched across this hole in the ground. In doing that, why the guy might get a wooden splinter in his behind. Well, what'd you do? You go for help. Nearest help was the hospital, which is right there in the same area with us. Okay, so you go down there and you get a Purple Heart for something as inconsequential as that. And yet the fellows were slowly dying of their wounds up on the other end up there, and they never got one because the doctors weren't up there.
Right, and it wasn't witnessed by two officers.
Right. Well, that's medals. Medals took two officers.
We're talking about the officers on page 163, Howard, that the officers were easy for the enlisted men to spot. They were the ones who talked the loudest about bravery, but who seemed to find so many important things to do just as the unit was moving out. They were the ones who always had to stop and straighten out some piece of gear or check a situation on the map long enough to be behind and not in front of their men. And if they were with the men, they were the ones who had to stop and talk to somebody in the rear on the radio whenever the going got tough. Howard, were any officers there with you in combat?
There were none with me. The other kid I was with was our senior man. He was a corporal, and I was second command. I was a PFC. We had people in between us to fill the squad out that had ratings, one as high as a master gunnery sergeant. With us, he was just a rifleman.
But you didn't see the officers on the line really that much.
There weren't any officers left. They were gone. They were killing them off faster than they could bring them up there.
You say here on page 163, I think that what rankled us more than anything was the officer's superior attitude towards enlisted men. Some displayed plain, overt contempt. Others just disregarded your existence. These misguided souls honestly believed it was only right that they, being officers, should be protected. After all, they had college degrees to prove how smart they were, and Congress had told them that they were gentlemen. They would talk loudly among themselves and to the troops, though everyone would know that they were not ordinary riffraff like the enlisted men who were being sent up to the line.
I wasn't paying that much attention to it until probably between sometime around B+4 and 7. Up till that time, the officers that were with us were the officers that were going to be officers, were going to be there with the men. Fine. We had no problem with that. It was these that came in at the later date to fill the holes in the back. In other words, all the good officers had been killed or wounded or something, and we were getting a lot of replacements that were like us that wouldn't have been there if the thing had been over with, but they just weren't the same caliber. That's all I can say.
Okay. Ray, what about your experience with the people in the rear and the officers?
I've read a number of different books on the war and the Marine Corps and stuff like that, and I know that I've heard some different opinions, and some fellows really disliked the officers considerably, and they may have had a good reason for that. However, I will say that the officers in the company I was in, there was one that we had in training, and he disappeared later on. He really wasn't cut out for this. Maybe they'd give him a desk job or something. But all the officers that I went into battle with were killed. But we had some good ones. I respected them in our training, and I felt that they respected us. I didn't know of a really bad apple in the officers in our company. We had 9 or 10 officers or something like that. They were all killed. I was right there seeing 2 of them killed, and 2 of my favorites, our company commander, Captain Bachman, and the executive officer, I forget his name. These were both real good men. But I can understand, and I know that a lot of times officers get that way, or they think that they should be that way. I want to mention one other thing that I thought was kind of neat. Doesn't have to do anything with officers. It has to do with the people back in the rear echelon. Souvenir hunters. And some of the fellows from way back there with the nice clean uniforms, and they'd had a bath that morning. By the way, I hadn't bathed or changed my clothes in about 48 days from the time I put on that uniform until the time I took it off. But these fellows would come up clean shaven and everything, start wandering around up there where the action was. And these couple of fellows, they were looking for souvenirs. I'd never been a souvenir hunter. They wandered out and just started wandering out in front of the machine guns. And one of them turned to the sergeant and said, "Oh, by the way, where's the front line?" And he said, "You just crossed it." They backed up in a hurry. I have known some good officers, and then again, we had some bad ones. But the Japanese could identify officers, and they're the ones that they wanted to kill, and they did a very good job of that.
Right. I guess we can roll right into the part about the medals. If you don't know about it, you would think that people get medals and awards and letters of commendation because they deserve it. On page 167 and 168, this is chapter 17, up in the field where the medals grow, that 1 in 3 officers got medals and 1 enlisted man in 25. And we talked a little bit about how you need to be seen by a doctor in order to get a medal, to get an award, a Purple Heart. And you actually, Howard, were in line for a couple of medals for some of the things you did and 2 letters of commendation and also a Bronze Star. Did you get any of them?
No, I didn't get them. 1, the Bronze Star, that officer was killed that afternoon. There was nobody else to co-sign for him because he was the only officer in 500 yards of where we were, I guess. 1 for helping put a tank tread on a tank that had been blown off. That particular officer that was in charge of that, he didn't last out 2 or 3 days. The one where I picked up the grenades that were the sulfuric acid grenades that they were throwing in the intakes and the tanks, that one, everybody was all up to do about that. That officer was either killed or taken off the island the next day, and before long, why, some other officer had found these grenades and went on from there. So that was the extent of my worth in combat, I guess.
Right, and of course, you didn't even want the medals, as you say. They weren't important to you. What was important was getting the job done.
Right. In other words, you don't think about the medals until after the war. Oh, hey, you got to join the Marine Corps League and whatnot. And so I finally got up courage to go to one in San Jose about 3-4 years after the war was over. And I got in there, and hey, everybody's Colonel somebody, and had to have a master gunnery sergeant to guard the door and have a bona fide chaplain and all the rest of this stuff. This is where the ribbons counted. These guys looked around there, and hey, this guy's got this ribbon and this one and this one. And I hadn't thought that much about them. I had some, and these guys are worried about them. If you didn't have X number of them, why, you really weren't there. So end up, it didn't have anything to do with what you did in combat. It had to do with who you know.
Right. Ray, how about you and your experience with the medals and awards and letters of commendation?
Those don't mean anything to me. I think someone who actually gets, and a lot of people deserve the medals they got, and I respect them for that. But all that stuff, it just doesn't mean anything to me. As I wasn't a souvenir hunter either, I was very proud of serving and doing what I was told to do and doing it quite well. But a lot of the other stuff is politics and a bunch of BS. We had one man, a sergeant in our second platoon. His name was Paul Meredith. He was commissioned in the field as a second lieutenant. I think he may have made it through the battle. All the other officers were killed. I was nicked a couple times, and I didn't get back to the battalion aid station where you could sign in and you get officially wounded. Hell, I got knocked on my ass one time. I guess it was a mortar or something. I still don't know what it was that hit me. I was about 8 feet up in the air and fell down. A couple guys came running over, and one was a medic and corpsman, and my left leg hurt a little bit. It seemed to work, and I got up, and they said, let's go back to the aid station. I said, I'm okay. I'm going straight forward, and I did. I wasn't being a hero. I just wanted to get the job done. I also caught another piece of shrapnel in my leg. But a lot of that other stuff is just baloney and politics, and so I don't pay any attention to that. And there are men that have earned every possible recognition for their fine work and bravery, and I think that's fine. But a lot of that is a bunch of baloney. That's the way I feel about it.
Anybody wondered how tough it was there on Iwo Jima? Page 166, Howard, you write, one sign of the hellishness of the Iwo Jima campaign is that 27 CMHs were awarded for actions during those 5 weeks, almost exactly a third of the total number awarded to Marines for the entire war. That's a huge number. Now you're talking on the next page, page 167, that the guys who should have got the medals and the awards and the commendations didn't get them. And the ones who really weren't doing much except, like you said, getting splinters on their butts, they were getting the medals. They were close by to the other officers.
It's
just not right. That kind of angered me, and I'm sure that people who pick this book up and read it, they'll probably feel the same way.
I was very happy to say that I got back with the order of the double dog tag. Now,
yes,
maybe you
yes.
had this in the Navy, but if you had two dog tags, and if you were killed, they saved one for the records. And I came back with two meant that you lived through it. I'm very happy with that.
I did actually remember reading that was the only thing you actually brought back were the dog tags. You also said that you would have hung on to your uniform, even though it was so filthy and you couldn't wait to get out of it. But
I moved on. I had received $1 million education. It was that good, and I think it made a better person of me.
I want to say this, is that as we go down through the years, I guess, what your experiences are has a direct correlation to who you have for friends. So that it turns out that the friends that I have were all in combat. And the people that were REMS, they don't exist. Actually, I'm the only one left out of the five of us that were from this area that would associate with each other, because all these other people were living on our laurels, I guess is the word for it.
Right. I do remember reading that where you talked about, Howard, how you couldn't even relate to the people. And I think, Ray, I don't remember if you said something like that. For some reason, I'm thinking that both of you did. Maybe I'm wrong, but at least Howard, I clearly remember that when the guys wanted to hear about battle, how was it? Like anyone who wouldn't know, it was so hard to relate to these people. So this actually stayed with you your whole life, where the only people you could relate to were people who had been in a similar situation as you.
Right.
How about you, Ray?
Well, the way I see it, I think that I learned a lot, and I think it made a better person of me, and maybe it made me very, very happy to still be alive. That's about what I have to say about it.
Okay. The battle, there were about 23,000 men lost at Iwo Jima out of, I think you said, there were three Marine divisions, and each Marine division was about 20,000 in force. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
On page 288, Ray, you say that of the 230 or 240 we had when we landed, only a dozen or two of the originals were still here to leave.
Yeah, I think one of the fellows was, I think, the company clerk. And he'd mentioned to me back in Hawaii, he said, I think we may have had a dozen or a couple dozen men of the guys that landed. But
yeah.
240 men. Not all of them were killed. There were some of them that were wounded, went out to the hospital ship, and some of them even sent them back into the battle.
Right.
Patch them up and send them back in. But the number of the guys that walked off the island, hell, you could put them in this room, and this room isn't very big.
Right. And the 5th Marine Division, you say, Ray, on page 290, had suffered 8,770 men killed or wounded, well over 40%. So 40% of the entire 5th Marine Division was out of commission.
We lost a lot of men. It was last year at church, It may have been Veterans Day, and the minister was mentioning maybe a prayer for the fallen comrades and stuff like that. And I could picture myself up on top of Suribachi, and I could see the whole island, and I saw some 6,000 men out there, or 6,000 gravestones, and these were 6,000 young men who would never be a father, and 6,000 daddies whose children would never see them again. I get emotional. After that experience, and I've mentioned this to some people, and I can't mention this without a lot of emotion, the last thing I would ever want to do as a Marine or as a person is to walk up on someone's porch with a Marine officer and a flag and maybe their son's dog tag or other memorabilia from the son they'll never see again. To have to tell mom and dad, this is what's left of your boy. That's how emotional I get. I never want to do that, and I guess I won't have to.
No, you guys made it. Well, it's difficult to find any humor in what you went through. There were plenty of instances where there was humor. Howard, there was a situation where on page 151, the subheading is Living Off the Land, where you say, one day fairly late in the fighting, Frank and I went to a supply dump in the rear to pick up more detonators for explosives. Tell listeners about that.
I always felt sorry for that fellow. He was only doing his job. He just happened to get caught in between the gears, that's all. We were coming back from the landing beach down there. Those people are nice and clean and whatnot down there. And we're dirty, and the pants and jackets are ripped and whatnot. And we picked up some detonators, and you're carrying them in one pocket, and you're carrying as much of the C2 as we could get a hold of. And so we're walking up the road, and you know, you put your thumb out, and nobody stopped. First of all, you're dirty, and then they see those packs that you've got with explosives, and they're not about to. And so finally, we got to the point where we were tired, so we decided we would stop the next unit that came along, which turned out to be an Army duck, which is your amphibian 6x6, I guess. And as we're talking to him, one's climbing up one side of the duck and the other one's on the other side and talking in his ear and whatnot, and told him he wanted to go up the front. Well, he couldn't go up to the front because they expected him at this food point. Well, okay, that's fine. But meantime, Frank has uncovered the corner of the back there and found out that the guy was carrying what was called 10-in-1 rations. And it was a new thing for General MacArthur's troops. They were getting them up there on the island. They were for captains and above were getting them.
Of course.
Of course. The object of the game then was to tell the truck driver that he'd have to take us to the front, that my buddy back here, one of his spells was taking over, and he was just not quite right. But if he'd help me get him up to the front, why, we'd make sure that the driver got back where he was supposed to be. So anyway, against his better judgment and the rifle that was pointed at the back of his head, why, he drove us as far up as we could get on a little spindly-ass road. And as soon as we gave a call out to get help, we had every infantryman within 20 miles come over and grab a box and take it. And we soon had the thing emptied, and we turned the guy loose and sent him back. And these 10-in-1 rations were set up to be enough rations for 10 troops for one day. So that meant they had breakfast, and they had lunch, and they had supper. And they had all kinds of goodies in there, and whether it was coffee or chocolate, or they had...
ham and lima beans was in there.
The lima beans, that was C's. We were tired of C's.
In the 10-in-1, they had ham and lima beans. Very good.
Yeah,
and butter. I remember that.
We had enough of them up there that we could go through the things and throw the stuff out that we didn't want. And somebody else would come along and they'd want that and whatnot. And we were feeding everybody up and down the line for a mile from us, I guess. And they all knew where it came from. So when, the Inspector General came around looking for this load of food that they didn't get down there, nobody knew anything about it. Never heard of it.
On page 152, you said, we politely told him he had no choice.
That's right.
How did you say it? Do you remember exactly what you said to him?
No, not really. We treated the guy nice. I really don't know what would have happened if he'd have said he wouldn't go. Neither one of us were that crazy.
You did have your weapons pointed at him.
They were loaded. And besides that, both of us were carrying pistols. We had the K-bars and, you know, all kinds of stuff that these people up at the front collect. But it was thoroughly appreciated by everybody up in the area where we took the stuff. Several officers up there that were in it, and they didn't know anything about it when they were asked, so they were some of the good guys.
And of course, the reason that this story is so enjoyable is because of what preceded it. And when you read the book, listeners, you'll find out why that is.
Yeah.
On page 243, Ray, you're talking about the K-Ravens. They would still probably last as long as the war, if not forever. And I thought, when I was in the Navy in the early 80s on our submarine, when we ran out of fresh food, of course, that's the only thing that limits how long a sub can be out, because the reactors last for over 10 years, the fuel does. They had sea rations from 1948. I remember seeing the stamp on it. So they do last forever.
Well, if you can heat them up, they're pretty good.
You guys could on the island because of the heat, right?
There's one time, I think it was back in Hawaii, that we were out on a field maneuver or something like that, and we were going to spend a night or two out there, and we came back to our camp for the night, and they had this cauldron of boiling water, and you could throw in a can of sea rations there, and it would heat it up. That's the only time I've ever eaten them when they were hot. Actually, they're pretty good meals, and I wasn't very hungry on Iwo Jima. I think when I came off, I'd lost about 25 pounds. You're too busy with other things to get hungry.
Like trying to stay alive.
I was farther up on the mountain than Ray, and we were up in where the ground was a little warmer, and you could heat those sea rations by digging a hole in the ground and setting them in there, and after some length of time, they were nice and warm, and you could have hot food.
You also had the benefit of carrying the explosives, though, right?
Oh, yeah.
That stuff would heat up pretty good.
Yeah, but the thing that off-limits use that we had to that was used to cut pieces of it off of the big bars, and you could heat coffee, cook your meals, whatever you wanted to do. The stuff would burn before it would explode. If it had a choice, it would burn.
American ingenuity. Ray, there are five stories, and you could pick one.
I'm going to do the story about Ishiwara. This is the story about Ishiwara. This is about a Japanese soldier whose name I didn't know, and I named him Ishiwara. As we moved north, and probably I'd been there 2 or 3 weeks, we saw a large mound of stuff, and as we got closer, we saw that the stuff was food for us. They bring this stuff by trucks, and they unload the trucks, and they get the hell out of there quickly. And then later on, the different companies and battalions go and pick up the food that they need from this cache of food. And the pile was about the size of a garage, which was probably 10, 12 feet high. As we approached this, and we understood what this was, sometimes there were piles of dead Marines. This is very unhappy. And in this case, there were piles of food. We noticed after too long that this pile of food was not quite the same as other piles of food that we had seen. There was a character on top of the pile of food, and sometimes we kind of saw the Japanese soldiers as kind of like monkeys in the way they moved and the way they looked, and not meaning to disparage them, but that's kind of the way they appeared. And atop this garage-sized cache of food was a Japanese soldier. I have named him Ishiwara so I could give him the dignity of some sort of a name.
Right.
He had discovered the food here. Now, the Japanese had a very limited source of food and an even more limited source of water. There was no natural water on the island. If you dig down, you're going to get sulfur and fire. And so the only water that they could get would be shipped in, and we had disrupted their shipping, and or rainwater. So this Japanese was sitting on top of this pile of food, opening cans and containers of food and eating. They were starving to death.
Right.
They had little food and little water, and I'm sure that they relished and used very well any ammunition that they had. But this poor guy probably hadn't eaten for a week or two, and he was opening things and eating and having a wonderful time. And even though we were in battle with these people, I guess we had some sort of sympathy for them. He was hungry. And we let him eat for 2 or 3 minutes and enjoy himself and slip into the next world, at least not hungry. We shot him. Now that's the story about Ishiwara.